environment. In the context of the death penalty, how should America address its questions related to this? So while we're talking about that, it seems appropriate to also look at the question of war and the question of fighting terrorism. And let's say America's fight on terrorism. Obviously right now, very much Israel's fight on terrorism is very, very much on our minds. But just to kind of highlight the universal nature of the topic and the fact that we had been talking about the death penalty specifically from a universal perspective. So let's frame the discussion as America's war on terrorism, and essentially the themes are basically overlapping. But I want to highlight again the fact that it's a question that's relevant really in a universal context. So let's come at it from that perspective. And of course, we're all horrified reading about, for now, it's more than a year, reading about the activities of ISIS, where we read about terrible acts of terrorism perpetrated upon a population, about captives taken hostage and horrific things happening to them, of material resources being seized, which pose the risk of even greater ability to wreak havoc on the world. And the truth is, we read something very similar in the parsha a few weeks ago. That's essentially described in Parshas Lech Lecha, in the same general region of the world. That's essentially what's happening, and Lot is taken captive, and Avram is called into his defense. And that war is, to some degree, a template. It's not only very evocative in a lot of details of some of the scenarios that we're dealing with today, that we're looking at today, but it serves a little bit as kind of a template to the whole idea of war in the future, both war as far as it relates to the Jewish people. Rav Soloveitchik commented about that section in the Chumash, about how this is the lot of the Jewish, no pun intended, the lot of the Jewish people to be swept up into the forces of conflagration and military conflict that are swirling around it. And Rav Hirsch comments similarly in that psuk, in that those psukim, that the very location, simply of Eretz Yisrael, right there at the crossroads of Europe and Asia and Africa, make it inevitable that the wars are going to take place all around it, and that the Jew will be pulled into the story. And the Rosh Yeshiva, Zichron Levrach, I often quote the writings of my Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Avner of Goldwich, but one of his most well-known essays, the many volumes of his writings that we quote from here, called Asufas Marachos. But there was an essay that he wrote that was printed much earlier than this and was really one of his signature pieces about the concept of malachim and melchamos, about kings and wars and warfare in general, coming from this section in Parshas Lech Lecha about the war of the four kings and the five kings. And he expands on the fact that wars exist. The Kadosh Baruch Hu has allowed a world in which wars exist because there are vital causes in this world where you're going to have to take a stand, where you're going to have to do something. And therefore, in order for these great causes to be defended, so we need a concept of war. But like everything else, once now war exists in the world, so people of evil ends will take that tool and we use it for their own ends. So it's essentially like everything else, that everything that exists in this world exists for some purpose, but it can be co-opted and used for evil. So too, the whole notion of war comes from the fact that it represents the willingness to defend to the death great causes, but by its very existence, it's also therefore available to be used by evildoers and by horrible people towards horrific ends. So we have a reality of war, which unfortunately has been with us for a long time, and we expect will be with us at least for now. We hope any moment that will end, and that the Bias HaMashiach, whatever exactly the Bias HaMashiach entails, we know that at the very least it's about peace, it's about bringing harmony to the world, and that we should not be in a state of war. But we also have prophecies that at least up until right before that, we're going to be dealing with perhaps Rahman al-Assan ever intensifying war, and we have to figure out a little bit how we relate to such things. And the fact that it's inevitable that people will die and people who are innocent will die, and sometimes people who are innocent will die at the hands of our own governments. And how exactly do we relate to that? This week's parasha, we read about the birth of Yaakov. Yaakov, in a few weeks, we read about also the beginning of the conflict between him and Esav in this week's parasha. So following that, in parasha's Vayishlach, so we know we read also a little bit about war. The very beginning of Vayishlach is about Yaakov preparing for a confrontation with Esav, hoping that it won't be war, but at the same time preparing for a military type of conflict. And the pasuk tells us that Yirah Yaakov Ma'od Vayetzer Lo, that Yaakov was very afraid and he was also anguished. Seems a little redundant. And we're probably familiar with the comment of Rashi over there that it's two things, that he was afraid that maybe he would be killed, and also he was anguished at the thought that maybe he would kill others. And the Balei HaTosfos, some of their showing me as a question, which always kind of bothered me in terms of the question, because the answer, I think, is easy to arrive at, but maybe there are a number of answers that are all relevant here, that on the one hand, he's afraid of being killed, that's Vayirah, and Vayetzer, he's afraid that maybe he will have to kill someone else. So the Rishonim raised the question, okay, but what's so terrible? So if somebody else is trying to kill him, if somebody is a Rodev, so we know that we have a principle of Habal Hargecha Hashkeim Lahargo, that if somebody is trying to kill you, so then you have the right to kill him. So what's Yaakov afraid of? So the question always bothered me, and again, I think it's easy enough to address that question, but maybe there are a couple of different points that it's getting at. So one would assume that the basic answer is that nobody wants to have to kill anybody, that there's always a moral cost, and there's always a cost in other terms to having to kill anyone. And no matter whether this person is a rodef or not, it doesn't take away all of the associated issues, or at least does it remove all of the associated issues that come along with killing someone. So it's not hard to understand why Yaakov here is afraid at the possibility of having to kill someone, even if that person is a rodev. Some have also suggested that the concern is that maybe he would end up killing somebody who's not a rodev, that maybe in the fog of war there would be a death that would take place in his hands that wouldn't be justified through the framework of Rodev, and that's what he's afraid of. So the truth is, the question is worth it for yielding both answers, that they're both concerns. That on the one hand, we don't want to have to kill anybody, and even if that person is classified as a Rodev, so that's not something that we would take easily or that we would be happy about, or that would not give us any kind of pause. And together with that, we're even more afraid that maybe there's somebody who doesn't really rise to the level of a rodef who may end up being killed. And of course, that's significantly more anxiety-provoking. So we find this perhaps by Avraham Avinu. We read in Parshas Lech Lecha that following the war, so there is an interaction. We saw this a little bit, and I think it was in Chamishi for this year, so we talked a little bit about the interaction between the king of Sdom and Avram, that here the king of Sdom is bringing Avram all of this bounty, all of this loot, all of this money that was conquered. He wanted to share it with Avram, and Avram is not interested, but there is a whole background there. In the Sefer Chabetzal Sasharon, actually, there is an essay about this, where you find the Chazal comment that Avram was anguished himself after this war because he was worried. Was there nobody innocent among the people who were killed? Maybe this wasn't legitimate. Maybe people died in his hand who shouldn't have died. And that was a topic of anxiety for Avram. So to a certain extent, that was assuaged by the bringing of all of this material benefit. Why? Because Avram was concerned, okay, so here Lot's life is in danger. So there is a halacha of Hatzalim and Harodev that you are allowed to come and save somebody who's a nirdav, somebody who's being chased to the death. And you can do that by killing the Rodev. But here in this context, presumably there were other people who were also killed. It was a war, it was a larger scale conflict. And therefore, Avraham was worried, how exactly do we look at this? That perhaps if it was a war, so okay, so then maybe there's room to include more people in this military action. We'll have to explain that in a second. But maybe this is a simple Rodef situation. So let's say if somebody is kidnapped in Manhattan and you want to go and save his life, so to do that, you're going to go guns blazing into the streets of Manhattan and kill innocent people while you're rescuing this guy. So we wouldn't think that that would be permissible. We would think that, okay, you have to save the person's life, and yes, you can do that at the expense of the Rodefim, but the innocent people who are in the street, you wouldn't have the right to do that. So Avraham was concerned that maybe that's what's going on. This was a Rodef kind of situation, like the streets of Manhattan, and innocent people who would be taken down, there was no justification for that. And the fact that there was a military aspect to it was proven by the fact that there was this conquering of land and of possessions. That's a halacha specifically in Muhammad. That's not something that we find outside the context of Muhammad. So that was a reassurance to Avraham that this was a genuine war. And in the context of war, okay, so then the rules are different and we view things a little more expansively. And then other people who may not necessarily be the direct perpetrator are perhaps more justifiably included in the idea of the conflict. So that requires also a little bit of explanation. So what is different about war? Right? So what are we talking about that war creates a different kind of environment than the scenario we mentioned before on the streets of Manhattan? So streets of Manhattan, you can't come out with guns blazing, but in a war, that's what happens. So what is the difference? David? Okay, that was quick. So, how exactly do you understand this scenario?
When he says guns blazing, what do you mean?
Means that if I was trying to, yes, thanks for the illustration, if you want to save somebody's life, right, so presumably I can take action against the guilty party who's directly threatening him, but I'm just going to shoot indiscriminately into the street and I'm going to hit innocent people. So what justification do I have to do that? But in a wartime context, that's basically what happens, right? The troops come and they land on the beach and they come and they have guns blazing. And whoever is hit, or certainly if you're talking about bombs and the like, and you're talking about much more than guns blazing, you're for sure taking in innocent people at that point in time. So what's the difference? How do you draw the line to distinguish between the Manhattan, keep talking about Manhattan because I'm thinking about crime. It's like we have a criminal environment where you're taking action against criminals, and you have a military environment. So Baruch Hashem, we haven't seen, well, depending on how you view 9/11, we don't see war on the homeland here. We haven't seen war take place in Manhattan. So I keep coming back to Manhattan as an example of a crime-based environment rather than a actual battlefield. So what's the difference between criminal justice and a wartime context? So we could view it really in two ways. We could, and this again builds on a lot of what we've seen so far. And they yield very similar principles. And that's helpful perhaps to give us a little bit of a framing mechanism. So on the one hand, so it's true when it comes to a normal Rodef situation like in the Manhattan situation, so we shouldn't have the right to go after any innocent person. And in fact, that's a limitation that we have in general that's reflected in the halacha of Yehari Vayavur. We know that there are a handful of halachas which we're not allowed to violate, less than a handful, three dinim, that we're not allowed to violate even to save our lives. And that means even to save someone else's life also. It's the same basic principle. So therefore, since Resicha is one of those three, so we're not allowed to violate Resicha even to save somebody else's life. So just like if somebody puts a gun to my head and says, shoot that innocent person or I'll shoot you, so you're not allowed to do it, you have to let him shoot you. So too, if somebody comes and says, shoot that innocent person or I'll shoot another innocent person, so you're still not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to save innocent person A by killing innocent person B. Now, why that is philosophically is an interesting question. That's a little bit outside the scope of today. We could talk about that a different time. It draws on other principles. But for now, we'll take that as a given that I'm not allowed to kill an innocent person, even to save an innocent person. So the justification of killing someone to save a life is only because that party is a guilty party. That party is the rodev. But when that person is not the rodev, so then we don't have such justification. So what's the story when it comes to war? So what's different about war? So pashtus is that war changes things on an identity level. That essentially war redefines our identity as individuals. So for example, the Menachas Chinuch and others have commented that war is clearly an exception to the idea of pikuach nefesh doches hakol. Because if we were to say that just like we're not going to keep Shabbos or we're not going to use fasting and kippur if it risks our lives, so if you're going to apply that same logic to war, so nobody would ever sign up for the army, right? So everyone is exempt from the army if that's the principle, because clearly they're undertaking a much greater risk than other situations where we very readily allow halacha to be overridden for pikuach nefesh. So clearly we're not applying the standard of pikuach nefesh, doches hakol, to a melchama context. But that's not the whole story. And that's step one. That what essentially that means is that really war, for the most part, is about pikuach nefesh. Now when we talk about, let's say, Dina Yisrael here, so we have categories of melchamas rishus and melchamas mitzvah, but again, specifically because we're looking at this in a universal context, let's assume a justified war for America to undertake. Right? There's no concept really of a Melchemes Rishus. What is a Melchemes Mitzvah in the context of the American government? So presumably if it's a war in self-defense or a war in defense of others, so that is justified. So America can go to war to protect itself, or America can go to war to protect other nations. So essentially what are we talking about when we talk about war? We're talking about the principle of rodef, but it's expanded to a national identity rather than an individual identity. So now, when it's America against Iraq, whatever it is, or America against the Nazis, so we're no longer looking at individuals, we're looking at nations. And now, one nation is trying to save itself by fighting another nation. As Shechter points out in Rikvei Atzon, where he talks about this, so we know it's also that presumably it would also extend to the existence of the nation itself. So let's say, for example, if some other country were to come to America and say, listen, we're taking over Washington, D.C. We're not going to kill anybody, but especially if you just let us come take over Washington, D.C. and make it a part of Russia, so we won't kill anyone, but that's what we're doing. So presumably America has the right to go to war for that as well. If they want to take Washington, D.C. or Washington Heights, even more tempting. So whatever it is, but that's also the pikuach nefesh of the country itself. And presumably the country has the right to protect its territory and its people, and that's all justified. So then we see the environment, again, as one of rodef, but rodef in a national sense rather than individual sense. And both directions, the Nirdof is the nation and the Rodef is the nation, and that becomes the essential perspective. So to really reframe what we said from the Menachas Chinuch and others, it's not that Pikuach Nefesh, Doches Hakol, is irrelevant to war. It's clearly relevant, it's just framed differently and judged differently. So the generals are going to make their decisions based on what will save the most lives, what will protect the most people. They won't take a step if it will cost a lot of lives. They're clearly making all their decisions based on pikuach nefesh considerations, but it's pikuach nefesh on the national scale rather than on the individual scale. So the individual doesn't have the right to say, I'm not going to go to war because it's dangerous, but how danger is assessed is certainly very much going to be a part of what's going on. Daniel?
Okay, so just to clarify, so from the individual sense, like on the streets of Manhattan, mm-hmm. you're not allowed to shoot someone unless you know he's for sure guilty?
Well, if he's a rodev, then you can shoot him. But if you're just going to shoot into the crowd, and you're going to risk the lives of innocent people in order to do that, so there's no justification for that.
And that's only okay to shoot into the crowd by war.
So the war, you're attacking the nation. So then America is fighting Germany, or America is fighting ISIS, however you want to define ISIS a little bit more ambiguous. Let's say America is fighting Iraq, so they can come into the country and start shooting because they're fighting the country.
Right.
Now, again, that doesn't absolve them of all. We'll get to the next step now in terms of how they're going to decide where they're shooting, but it's a different scale of a kind of decision. It's not the same decision on the individual level. Now, still there'll be major considerations, and we'll come to that in a second. Hi.
Surely factor in innocent civilians.
Sorry? Yes.
Within the nation.
Correct, right. So now, within that, so question about that?
This is, I guess, it's just clear. So, QAnon is relevant on both levels, on the national level. War is justified because of the national level, people have that for the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're getting into how it's still relevant on the individual level in terms of, like, innocent civilians.
Right, and that's even before, that's even separate from Pikuach Nefesh. Pikuach Nefesh is still a factor. It's not that, okay, because there's some magic concept of war, nobody cares about our self-protection anymore, and we just run out there and just sacrifice ourselves. We don't understand it that way. We understand that the nature of our decisions will be different than other types of decisions. So you're not going to look at a war question the same way you look at a fasting on Yom Kippur question. But it's not because pikuach nefesh is not a factor, it's because it's a factor that is assessed on a different kind of scale. So when we look at it from the perspective of Rodev, so then we find that Rodev has limitations. That Rodev, we don't just say that if somebody's trying to kill you, then you kill them. Rather, you say that you do what's necessary in order to save yourself. So, the Gemara, maybe we'll get to these things also sometime in the year. We'll have to decide what parts of Sanhedrin we're going to focus on. But these are Sanhedrin sugyas. So, towards the end of Masechta Sanhedrin, so we have the concepts of Rodev. So, the din is that in Yachal Hatzilo Be'achad Me'varav, then that's what you have to do. That if somebody is coming to kill you, but you could disarm them, or you could stop them, you could neutralize them, by hurting them rather than killing them, so then you're obligated to do that. You're not allowed to kill them. Some Achronim made a distinction, it's questionable whether this is true or not. Some Achronim thought that that's only true for third-party savings, that if you're trying to save someone else from a Rodev, so then you have to stop the Rodev, but if you can stop the Rodev without killing him, you have to do that. But the separate din of Habala Hargacha Hashkev Lahargo, that if somebody's trying to kill you, so then you have the justification to kill them. Some suggest that's without this limitation of im yachal atzilo be'achad me'varav. But let's assume for now that we don't make such a distinction. So to whatever extent one can stop this redifa without going that far, so one's obligated to do that. So presumably as far as assessing how you're going to wage war against the nation, so one has to evaluate, okay, so again, yes, my guns can blaze when they need to, but I don't just randomly blow up the whole country and blow up innocent people and the like, but I'm going to try to do my best to make the most surgically aimed attack so that I can attack those who are actually trying to fight me, those whose presence is what's really posing a danger, and the best I can to protect the lives of all those who are not relevant to that in this category of
Hi. So with the concentrations, how do we have people who are very often being in a position where they need to
Right.
Protect themselves, they're under attack,
mm-hmm.
But then they have to, I don't know, do you expect the Chesh Benal if I can kill, if I can hurt them without, like they don't mess around, they kill the person.
But that's a part, that's also a decision. The assumption is that there isn't a way to get this done without doing that.
Oh, that's
but there's a constant evaluation going on, there should be a constant evaluation going on, that on the one hand, I have an obligation to protect myself and my country, but if I can do that less, then with less force, then I do it with less force. But sometimes the consideration is, and I'm not trying here at all to second-guess any generals, because it's way, way beyond my field, but sometimes the consideration is, if we don't go with a certain amount of force, we won't be confident that we'll be able to accomplish what we need to, or the threat's going to come right back a minute later. So that's also a part of the assessment. It's also an interesting question to consider that when we're talking about the halachas of Rodev, so we know that the Torah has a parsha, and this again is a Sanhedrin sugya, we'll have to get to it, of a Baba Machteres, that if you find somebody in your house So then you have the right to kill him. And the assumption is that this person is, maybe there is robbed from you, but he knows that you are going to protect your property with your life. Therefore, it seems like he's prepared to kill you, if that's what it comes down to. And therefore, that justifies your killing him. So again, the details of that are complex, and we'll get to it, but it's worth questioning, is there a national model for that? What's a national model of Habab Machteris? And as far as working off the premise that this other national entity is trying to, or is ready to kill you, if that's where it goes, and to what extent are you allowed to respond to that, is something that's also interesting to consider, and perhaps relevant as well. So basically, we have a model of Rodef on a national level, and that perhaps allows this action defensively, but also, again, is not absolute. It's going to require us to make an evaluation, just like an individual near Duff would, how can he best save his life? So too, the national level, we have to make an evaluation, how can we best protect our nation while still doing as little damage to the Rodef as possible, in this case, meaning presumably emphasizing the protection of innocent people in the process. So essentially, perhaps that was Avram's frame of mind, that he was worried that they were individuals and that he was fighting an individual Rodef, and that maybe it wasn't legitimate that others got involved. While seeing it more as a military context, as was indicated by other things, allowed for a broader scope towards it. Now, another model, this we'll be able to go through more quickly because we've spent a lot of time talking about these principles, but one could also approach war, especially a third-party kind of war that America has often been involved in over the past few decades, where sometimes America is directly attacked and sometimes other countries that are attacked and America has gotten involved. So we've talked about the framework of Din and the idea that we saw from the Rambam in the context of Shimon and Levi, that the nations of the world, however we want to define it, whether you want to look at it as a government acting domestically, internally, or whether you want to define it as all the governments as part of one global society, and therefore empowered and obligated to take action against other governments also. So when there is a widespread violation of principles of din, let's say of Ritzicha, of Gezel, and the like, so we saw that the Rambam says that din means that the others are required to take action to do something about that, and if not, they bear some guilt themselves. That was why Shimon and Levi took action against Shechem. So here too, we could say that through the prism of din, there is the obligation to do what's necessary in order to stop these egregious violations. And if you recall, so we saw from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik that din is not necessarily absolute either, as he understood it, but that it's a matter of discretion. So one could probably argue that just like a civil society judge, a judge in a domestic context, is going to assess what do I have to do in order to keep society safe. So do I have to execute this person, or is it possible to impose a lesser punishment that will have the same effect? So too, there is an evaluative component. So clearly the mitzvot of Noah are being violated every day all over the world to a tremendous degree. But at what point is it threatening enough to world order for others to decide they have to get involved aggressively? So maybe that's somewhat subjective, but presumably that's also an issue here. Recall, this is somewhat evocative, the Rambam's framing of the idea that the city of Shechem is all liable for execution because they failed to impose din on the individual of Shechem, and that therefore they were somewhat complicit because of failing to do din. You may be too young to remember, but after 9/11, so George Bush declared that if you harbor a terrorist, you're a terrorist. That this is making war against the terrorists, and that that doesn't only limit itself to those who actually committed the acts, but those who are part of stopping, who are part of not stopping it, part of allowing it to happen under their noses, are also going to be legitimate targets for war. So that's also a part of this whole framework, that perhaps that could be seen in the Rambam's idea of din, that there's a requirement to impose justice, and failing to do so could make one complicit, and then perhaps other entities are going to be required to take up the salvation of the world within that framework. But again, if we take the Ravaran Soloveitchik's approach that we mentioned in the domestic context, that the judge should not necessarily impose the death penalty all the time, but rather should use a discretionary understanding of when to and when not to. So too in this context, maybe it's legitimate for one nation to go to war in order to address this issue, but again, to make a discretionary decision how to do so in the most effective and fair way possible, which again is going to mean taking great effort to avoid any civilian casualties that are unnecessary. So it's interesting also, there is a third approach to the issue of Shimon Levi and the whole question of killing the apparently innocent people in Shechem. So you have, on the one hand, the Rambam, who understood it as a function of the mitzvah of din. You have the Ramban, who basically disagrees and essentially doesn't think it was justified, and that's how you read the psukim, that Yaakov was angry at them because it wasn't justified. The Maharal of Prague, in his commentary over there, had another understanding that was similar to what we've been saying so far, that basically it became an issue of Muhammad, that the city of Shechem essentially is a national entity and was therefore at war with the Bnei Yaakov, and it became legitimate to take action against the city. So it's a question whether to accept that interpretation or not, but it also puts it in this common framework. So it's interesting, there is a tshuva here. Rav Asher White Shlita has a tshuva that was printed in his Sefer Minchas Asher in Parshas Shoftim. So just to quickly look, he discusses this issue. Just thought I would share it with you quickly. So it's not clear who he's addressing here, but somebody interesting. Because he writes, "Vasha bikesh many mouths kvaidish miskeres of adas of arts of this Europa," that this individual who asked the question, the framework of his work in America and Europe, nifkash and rabbi mechugi hamemshal v'haskala l'fam omer huchasu omer vein pivifiv ma'ane binyan hapomlish mesar brach v'olam binyan harugim harabim bekerav achusia haravis melchemes v'vitzva atzolos v'al menakam olayim meibin hamitzar mishnas tashtach. Well, so he's talking about defending Israel in the eyes of the war, the eyes of the world, of America and Europe, people who challenge the war on terrorism, etc. Here that many anti-Semites have found here a place to gore the God's nation and the Torah and attack them for their actions. And here the murderous terrorists intentionally hide themselves behind the backs of women and children and use them as shields. So what's the attitude here towards innocent people under those circumstances? So he writes that we could investigate this issue from the perspective of Rodev, that when you might say that when you have a civilian population which supports the murderers, so maybe they also have the status of Rodef, who's trying to kill someone. And even if these supportive population members are not themselves the Rodefim, But we do find that the Achronim do have the status of Radifa Ali de Grabba, somebody who's causing a Radifa, and he cites here the Achiezer, the Divrei Chesko. So maybe that's one way to look at it. He goes, however, he says that's not correct, because even if you say there is such a thing as a Rodef Ali de Grabba as an indirect Radifa, so that's only somebody who's basically doing a straight Radifa, but he's not doing an action of killing. But you can't prove from here that also a roundabout kind of Radifa is also called Rodef, and therefore he thinks that it seems pretty obvious to him that women and children who are not actually doing the Radifa in any kind of straight way, they do not have the status of a Rodef, even if they are supportive of terror and they are encouraging the murderers and supporting them, and especially when it's possible that among these people who would be killed are children who are not even of the age of awareness, not Bnei Das, so, and they're completely pure, that wouldn't have any active support. Now, we know, to our great horror, we've seen many stories recently of very young terrorists, so how exactly you define innocent in childhood is an open question here, but clearly there is an age beneath which one has any capacity for independent judgment. So as you're saying, that we certainly have to worry that there will be children there who have no definition of being supportive in any willing way of the terrorist action, so it's hard to call them a rodef in that sense. He says, perhaps you could give a different reason, and that's based on the Chazon Ish. So here, this is interesting. This I heard from him in person once. And I heard of Asher Weiss quote this Chazon Ish and say, you see from here that the Chazon Ish was a Rishon. The Chazon Ish was in a status that was a different level. Now, just to make sure you're not confused by that, chronologically, he was not a Rishon. He died 60 years ago, but he was saying that his level of creative authority put him on the level of a Rishon. So this was something relevant. Do you have a question about this?
So this is still within the approach of using the concept of din that we discussed?
Well, here he's focusing now on Rodef, is what he starts talking about. He says, okay, so the Rodef you can kill. But should we say that a population, a civilian population that supports these actions but don't actually participate in them, do they all have a status of rodef? He says that's difficult to say. And it doesn't seem to be enough. Now, he quotes this Chazon Ish here, which he says is indicative of Chazon Ish's status as a Rishon, which addresses the famous trolley problem. Familiar with the trolley? Did we talk about it in Shira? We talked about it in another class. The famous trolley problem is a philosophical question. There are at least several books that have been written about this recently, whole books about this question. That, let's say you have, you're watching a trolley that's going down a railway, and you see that it's about to hit, it's in a direct collision course with five innocent people. It's going to run over these five innocent people. And you have the ability to switch the path. You can pull a lever and switch the path of the trolley. So the trolley will avoid hitting these five innocent people. But there's one innocent person on the other path. So now you are going to cause that innocent person to get hit by the trolley. So are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to direct this trolley at an innocent person? And in doing so, to save the lives of these five innocent people. Can you make that kind of calculation? 5-1. Now normally we said before, they hardly ever, they're not allowed to kill innocent people. And we find that applies even if the numbers are lopsided. So if somebody says, kill this person or I'll kill five people, you're still not allowed to do it. Even though, again, you can question philosophically why that is based on the Gemara and Sanhedrin, and maybe we'll talk about that in a different context. But for now, we'll take it for granted that that's the din. So is this any different than that? Is this different than just randomly shooting a, I shouldn't say randomly, but shooting a person to save five other people? So this is a question that philosophers have struggled with, various components. So Chazon Ish's approach to this question was that this is permissible because your whole act is an act of Hatzalah. That what you are doing, you're not killing anybody. What you're doing is saving these people. You're pulling this lever to move the trolley away from these five people. That is an act of saving innocent lives. Now, it happens to be that in the process, somebody else will die. But that doesn't change the fact that you have presumably two components that are significant. One, more people will be saved than will die. And two, your action, this is equally important apparently, your action is an action of saving and not an action of killing. So perhaps that should be the approach you could take here. Okay, so I'm not looking to kill anybody. I'm looking to stop the terrorists. And it happens to also be that people will be killed. Maybe that could have been a justification. Hi.
But in the case of you shoot one person or the guy's going to kill five people, that because you're going to do an act of mitzvah, that's why you can't do it?
Right. You know, that becomes the whole focal point. That your action is an action of resicha, and that's what's prohibited, as opposed to an action of saving. So before Drassman's point is correct, he notes that this is also perhaps reflective of an idea of someone closer to Rishonim, but still technically an Achron, the Pnei Yehoshua. The Pnei Yehoshua, if you ever knew his story, so there's an R-Scroll children's book about the story of the Pnei Yehoshua. I remember reading this as a kid, and this whole story is told there, that the Pnei Yehoshua was trapped in a terrible fire, and he made a commitment that if he was saved from the fire, that he would write Svarim on Shas, where he would go through everything very carefully and explain the Rashi and the Tosfos and explain everything. So he wrote his Svarim. After that, there's recognition of his commitment he made while he was trapped in the fire. So in the discussion of the fire in his Abdamma, Rashi always quotes here that Bnei Yeshua writes about that fire, that it was a terrible fire and many people died, and people died also as a consequence, not only the fire, but out of what was going on to try to stop the fire and try to save lives. It happened to be also that there were people who were killed by the rescuers, or by things the rescuers did that caused people to die. But he wrote that his language was, he quotes here, that there was no other way to do it. They couldn't save the people they saved without taking actions that caused other people to die. And emphasis, that this was all an attempt at rescue, and if it also resulted, sadly, in people dying, so that's excused in a sense because it was coming as a function of saving people. But he says that that's hard to apply here, because besides the fact he writes the Chazon Ish, it's interesting here that in writing he's a little more critical about it. Because again, when I heard this from him, he was very complimentary towards the Chazon Ish's innovative thinking. But here he writes that Mavad Masha Divrei Chazon Ish Mechudash Mad Mo'od, besides the fact that it's a big chiddush, implying that we can't necessarily accept it, says V'ulei Dvarav Hayanira Pashet V'Shum Panav Oifrin Lahargas Yachkei Lahatzel Sarabim. Without his chiddush, I would think that in no circumstances should you be able to kill the innocent, even to save more innocent people. Nira Da'afim Naniach Dvarav. Even if we agree with him, Ein Hanida Daimel Araya. That's not really comparable. Daftusasas Bayish Yeshbo. That blowing up a building that has innocent people in it, that's not considered to be an act of saving, that's considered to be an act of killing. So that Maisa Hariga, the Torah allows when the person is trying to kill you. But if you're going to kill people who didn't come to kill, so ma heter yesh lahargam. So what justification do you have to kill those people? V'od dami. Right. So, other issues he brings with this is basically he's not ready to apply the Chazon Ish svar. Even if you accept it, doesn't think that it applies him.
Just like not blowing up the building with terrorists to kill all the other people in the building as well. He's talking about.
He's saying that that action is a ma'isa hariga. You can't say that. Well, I killed people, but I'm doing it through saving people. Here, you're killing people. Now, the killing of the right person is justified because of the din of rodef. But how do you know that that extends to anybody else? So the Chazon Ish's explanation doesn't think is going to be adequate here, even if you accept it.
Why can't you look at the Hatzalah aspect and ignore the rest?
He said because when you move the trolley from one thing to another, so okay, so that's an action of saving. You're trying to take this streaming, this speeding train and push it away from the innocent people. And it happens to be someone else is in the way. But here you're shooting at people, you're blowing up people, that's a violent act. So that's not an act of hatzala. It's only justified because of the halacha of rodef. But rodef is only relevant to the rodef. It's not relevant to the other people. So he goes on to say, nira v'zeh. Da'afim lo nimtza heter l'nidun didon v'din makol shoydef hatzala. That even if we can't use the din of rodef to explain this, dinei milchama shani, the laws of war are different. And in the laws of war, it's permissible to affect innocent people also if it's impossible any other way. Now, this halacha we don't find in the Gemara and the Poskim, but we find it in the Tanakh and in the Mefarshim. And that's because from the time of the Churban Habayis and the negation of Malchus Yisrael, so these questions were not relevant to us, l'maisa. And not too many people have looked into these sugyas, he writes. And therefore, we have to base our positions on how they're explicit in Tanakh and in the Mefarshim throughout the generations. And to establish that, we have a little discussion here about Ein Lamed Halacha Me'Agada, that you can't use Agada to learn Halacha. But he says that's talking about Agadas Chazal, but if there's a story in the Gemara, so it's hard to know how to use that for Halacha. But the story is in Tanakh. That's not called Agadita. So he has a little bit of discussion about that. So then he goes on to say, after that point, says, it seems that we could establish Mekam Makarish Vishas. I can find from many places. that Shoshas Muhammad, that in the middle of war, me afshel if goa belochman shabbat later lahargainu, elaba ofen shayifku vihargu anashim, meaning that if there's no way to protect ourselves from those who are trying to hurt us, except to also hurt innocent people, motilasoskin. So that it's permissible to do that. And to explain that, he says I can give you two different approaches. So one is, he mentions what we started off with, Vayira Yaakov Mod Vayezalot, Yaakov's great fear and anxiety, and Rashi that we mentioned, he's afraid that he might get killed, and he was anxiety-ridden that maybe he'll have to kill someone else. So the Gur Aryeh of Maharal, Maharal Efrag writes over there, that he doesn't mean to say that he was worried he might have to kill Esau. Because Esau was a legitimate target. He was the one trying to kill him. But he was worried that maybe he would also have to kill the people with him. And Mizrahi writes that even though they were also Roshan, because they were also after Yaakov's camp, still Yaakov was worried that in the fog of war, Sarah Sakra, he'll kill also those who he could have saved, he could have stopped the Achad Mevar. But maybe it'll be a situation where somebody who died didn't have to die and he will have miscalculated, and that's what he's worried about. So the Maharal writes, the Afshim is stubbo lahara, that even though they're probably coming to kill him, and therefore it was mutter to kill them, maybe they didn't come with Kavana, and therefore it would have been an Aver B'sholi. So he writes here, Rav Asher, that the Dvarim Dechukim Ma'od, these are very tricky words, very difficult words. Lulay Dvarim Nirin Hizad Darach HaMuhammah. If it were not for this, I would have said that that's what the Muhammad is. The Kevich Machne Esav, Bal Hilach and Yaakov, that since the camp of Esav came to fight with Yaakov, what to the Hashem Muhammah? So I wrote the Kevich and Nitner Rishos LaHashmin Shimon Amachin and Tovara, that you're allowed to fight with full force. That even if innocent people die, so the blame is on the attacker, is on the enemy. And it's not on the shoulders of the one who's trying to save himself. But still, Yaakov was a tzaddik, so he was worried that maybe that would happen, and he didn't want that to be the case. So he notes here that it's interesting that Maharal of Prague seems to contradict himself. Because we mentioned before the Maharal's approach to Shimon and Levi in Vayishla. So there he seems to be okay with the approach that Shimon and Levi take, that they view Shechem as all one entity, and see it from a perspective of a national conflict. So what's the difference here? So why doesn't he say also, so Yaakov could see Esau's team as a national entity, and therefore consider it legitimate, that here Shimon and Levi clearly were not worried about the innocent people, they actively went after the innocent people. So he says, L'chorim espar mitoch divrei Maharal, v'zeh taras mochama. So it seems what Maharal is saying is that this is what mochama is. Shekol u'ma nechshevas l'gufecha, the whole nation is considered to be one entity. And everyone is involved in that. So it's all considered to be as one entity, and therefore they are fair targets. And based on that, then we see that one doesn't necessarily have to make a distinction. So what's the difference then in the situation of Yaakov? So it says you could say three ways. You could say that yes, it's true that it would have been mutter, but Yaakov still, because he was very pious and very pure, still didn't want anyone to die and was worried about that. Or two, maybe Maharal's words in Vayishlach are only relevant to two national entities, as he says. But in the case of Yaakov and Esau, here there are two brothers, and Esau's coming to kill him, and this is not really national entities conflicting with each other, so therefore there's no basis to allow innocents to be included. Or three, says Lui Divrei HaMaral, where Nafin Maral says near its fake canal, I would have said more, like I said above, Shekach Derech HaMochama, that this is the way of Mochama, the Yeshlit Star Al Harigasim Shalchaf Mepesha, that one should feel sorrow on the loss of innocent people. Ah, Hashem Berei Ramanos, but if there's no other way, there's no escape, Mutal of Goa Af Bechaf Mepesha, then it's permissible even to go after the innocents. Ubnei Yaakov at Tzadikim, Shem Volei Vichosh, Uyidu Begoa Adaz HaMetzach, Shem Shem Ben Chamor, Shehei Zatam Yispas Yaakov, that here you see that they were so brazen, that Shem Levi felt that Shem, they were so brazen in what they did in attacking the daughter of Yaakov, so it must be that this is an act of war and that they're willing to do anything, that they're willing to go after them with total viciousness, and therefore they felt that this is what they had to do to protect themselves. And Yaakov didn't assess it that way, and therefore he was very angry, as the Psukim indicated. So what we see here is that there's two different paths in understanding the Salacha. On the one hand, the understanding of the Maharal, that during the Lachama we don't look at the individuals, we just look at the national entity. But, says Uvashur, Lulei Dvarav HaNir Yoser, that were it not for his words, I would say that it's more likely the case to Dimi Yuchar Hu B'Taras Mochama, that this is a distinct law in Taras Mochama. That it's permissible to kill the soldiers, even if that means innocent people are involved in that. But if it's impossible to avoid that. So again, the emphasis is that on the one hand there's a general legitimacy, but at the same time it's crucial to make sure that there's no other way, that it's only because this is absolutely necessary, and if there's any way to save the lives of the innocents, so then that has to be a priority as well. And here he has a little bit of a footnote here where he talks about warning the nations and about making sure that to whatever extent innocent people are separated out from the targets. So that is the imperative, but the reality is that every war in history does involve some innocent people dying. So what's the justification for that in light of the principles of Ritzicha? So we've seen a couple of possible avenues that address that. But the bottom line is, again, we pray every day for the Bias of Mashiach. Again, whatever that means, we know that it should mean an end to all wars, it should mean peace in the world, and that the time should come when we no longer have to deal with any of these issues and any of their details. Can you hear us? Okay, so we'll stop here. Again, tomorrow, we'll be at the beginning of Nusugis, post-Mishnah, and...